Did you hear him talking about it on the radio? Did you try to read the writing on the wall? Did that voice inside you say, I've heard it all before? It's like deja vu.
And a long, hard road it's been. Welcome to The Long Haul, a new monthly radio program KMXT is rolling out in collaboration with the Kodiak History Museum. We're 2 years and counting in this pandemic, 2 years of waiting and watching as our community has struggled to navigate its way through pain, uncertainty, and disruption that COVID-19 has brought into our lives. It's been a long haul for all of us, and that's what's going to be our focus over the next few months as we sit down with some of our neighbors to talk about where we were, where we are, and where we're going in regard to making it through the pandemic. If you'd like to ask questions of our guests, please call the station at 486-3181 or send your questions to longhaul@kmxt.org during the show. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. If you'd like to participate in a future program, either call the station or send us an email. The Long Haul, stories from the pandemic in Kodiak. Here's today's host.
My name is Lynn, and I'm here with Mike today, and we are your hosts this morning. This is The Long Haul, a collaboration between KMXT and the Kodiak History Museum, where we reflect on where Kodiak has been and where we're going in this pandemic. Today's topic is mental health, and we are joined by a couple of guests today. We have Susan Philo from Providence, Heidi McNerney from Kodiak Community Health Center, and Jocelyn Figreed from CANA. Thank you for coming on to the show and welcome. I think we can start with everyone kind of introducing themselves and what they do.
Okay, I'll start. My name is Jocelyn Figureed. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I've been a behavioral health clinician with CANA for almost 5 years.
And my name's Heidi Barrett McNerney, and I am a licensed clinical social worker, and I work as a behavioral health therapist at the Kodiak Community Health Center.
Good morning, I'm Susan Philo. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I've worked for 11 years at Providence Counselor Center in the role as team lead for a school clinician program and also as a counselor there.
So before we go into the questions, what is each of you's normal, do you have a mix of clients that you work with? Do you work principally with kids? Do you work with adults or, you know, of your responsibilities, what's primarily your day-to-day role?
This is Jocelyn. I primarily work with adults, but I also work with teenagers. And I have several clients on my caseload now, ages 12 and up. Mostly do individual work, but I have done some groups before, and hopefully we'll be starting another group at CANA later this year.
And I work with all age groups, from children, usually from about the age of 5 up through adults. I see all kinds of...
Excuse me, Heidi. Yeah. It's the next one over, the next microphone over. Yeah, that'll give us a little bit better noise.
Okay.
Should have told you that beforehand.
Right. No problem. So I work with children from the ages of about 5 up through adults, and all kinds of different problems, depression, anxiety, ADHD. The kind of the purpose of my role in the clinic is to provide short-term brief interventions and then refer on if people need referral. But because of the pandemic, that has changed greatly. And so I see patients now longer term, And it's been difficult to refer, as both Jocelyn and Susan know, the wait lists are very long. So recently we've started using a counseling service out of Anchorage. The only problem with that is it's not face-to-face, it's all telehealth. And telehealth works for a lot of people, but it doesn't work for everybody, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is Susan. My primary role is as a counselor. I see patients 5 to 6 a day, and I also supervise 2 school counselors that are do mental health at the high school and middle school. I see ages, my youngest client is age 5 and my oldest is 75, but generally I see adults.
Good. Well, you know, there's so many issues that you people deal with on a day-to-day basis that affect the community as a whole, but before we even get into that type of question, I want you to reflect. I want you to take your hat off as a counselor, and not answer the question as a counselor. But I want you to talk personally about how COVID has affected you. You know, outside of your job. You know, we all tend to try and put the hat on and intermingle the hat that we wear as our job during the day to what happens when you take the hat off, and how has your life changed over the past 2 years? I mean, what have you had to do to cope? I mean, you have the skills, you have all the things that you work out at a daily basis, but this has to be hard on everybody. And
New hobbies, like a lot of people. Thanks to YouTube, you can learn how to do all kinds of things. I started baking. I was one of those people. And I bought an old bus from a church here and ripped it apart that first summer of 2020, which I think was really helpful for me at the end of the day and working from home. If it was nice, I would go outside and just work on it here and there. And I think that really helped me stay regulated. And I was so exhausted. I slept really well that summer.
Cool.
I think for me, part of it, this Heidi, has been, there was a time kind of in the middle where I just felt like I was languishing. I didn't really see myself making much progress. And then I was just surviving. This year, it's been a little better. I feel like things have opened up just slightly. I tend to feel really isolated sometimes. Not that I was a big socialite prior to the pandemic, but it just kind of made things seem even more isolated. And then there were times, you know, with holidays where I wasn't able to get together with the people I normally would get together with, and trying to create new ways of doing that, which I was able to do. But I go back to my routine. So I'm kind of a routine person. I do the things that I always do and do them over and over. And that seems to help me survive. So those things are like still getting together with people, but figuring out new ways to do that. Walking my dog religiously on a daily basis, and making sure that I'm getting outside and getting fresh air and getting some exercise, those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Susan. I think about when I first, you know, when the pandemic first started, and I think we all had that angst, you know, like, how are we going to handle it? What does this mean? What is this going to mean for all of us? I was in the high-risk group because I'm older, and I also have some lung issues. And so for me, it kind of brought on a little bit of an existential crisis. But, you know, it was really good for me to kind of face that, because it's something that we all eventually need to face, and to decide to live, you know. And so I was very deliberate in that, and was really deliberate in knowing the things that I needed to do, like find ways to connect with others, you know, even with those that I regularly see, I live with my husband and it can get stale anyway. But, you know, just because it's the same old, but, you know, being really intentional about connecting, finding ways to keep your life interesting, staying informed, like what, you know, what is really happening and staying on top of that. And also doing something, you know, agency towards, you know, making, you know, what will I do if I get sick? You know, planning it. What will I do if my friends get sick? What, you know, how would that look? And then continuing with routines. You know, I really just do what you normally do. I listened to this really great online presentation by a well-known psychologist, or actually, I think Bessel van der Kolk. Is he a psychiatrist or psychologist, guys?
I think he's a psychologist.
Anyway, he's well-known trauma expert, and he said, "Stay home and bake and make love and have babies." And I just thought, right on. You know, I mean, just live. You know, choose to live. And so I found myself, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to choose to live and not stay in fear. But you know, that low grade anxiety was definitely there. Yeah.
Are things getting better for all of you now? I mean, now that we've kind of navigated for 2 years, are we in a better position now?
I think so.
Oh, yeah, I think so. People are, they kind of can hear a little bit of a collective sigh, I think.
Yeah.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Now, mix that in with the workplace. I mean, did working help you throughout the pandemic? I mean, were hobbies and other activities, but was it more stressful to see what was going on in the community and you have to jump in and deal with that?
Yes, it was, but for me at least, I really feel that it also helped because I definitely had a sense of purpose. Some of my clients who were not able to work or things really changed, they struggled with that. And feeling helpless at times, and even though I felt helpless, there was plenty of work for me to do, and I was really glad that I could continue with my clients, pick up new clients, and I'm not sure how well I would have done if I hadn't been able to continue working, and obviously being able to continue working and getting a paycheck, I didn't have the financial strain that a lot of folks did, because that was really scary for a while. People didn't know financially what was going to happen. And that was an enormous stressor early on for a lot of people, understandably. And I was fortunate enough that I didn't have that. And I enjoy the work I do, even when it's stressful. So it felt good to continue working and actually doing the same thing and being there for people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Working really helped, because also I have that sense of purpose. My work is very fulfilling for me. And I think there were times when kind of being that person who was holding hope for other people also helped, because there's something about putting that energy out there and seeing people kind of be able to grab on to that and to carry that with them. That was also helpful to me professionally. I was really grateful that there was only a short period of time when I had to work from home, because I think the longer that had gone on, the more isolated I would have felt. And so that was a short-lived period, and I was grateful for that.
Yeah, I would agree with what Jocelyn and Heidi are saying, that the work really did help me, you know, to sustain me. There were times when I thought, you know, I need some support too. You know, however, you know, you figure that out. I also, you know, Heidi mentioned, you know, holding hope for people, and I think that's a huge thing of what we do as counselors, social workers. I also got so much hope from my clients when they would tell me stories. you know, of hope, you know, just something happy or unexpected that happened in their day. And it was mutual, you know, mutual sharing. But yeah, the work definitely, and having the paycheck, you know, that was really, I'm so grateful for that.
You know, I remember 2 years ago talking to you, Heidi, about the transition, though, from face-to-face counseling to telecounseling. Mm-hmm. And that was, as I remember it, quite, in a way it was easy, and in another way it was more difficult, and that the wait lists were pretty long. So has it become easier?
Well, telehealth for me certainly has become easier. Now it's like just a part of what I do. I still prefer doing face-to-face therapy, just because there's so much that comes across in body language, and you get a little bit of that through telehealth, but not in the same way. It still is really difficult. The wait lists are still really long, and I don't think that's going to change. I think the need for services is great right now, and I think it's going to continue to be great, because I think we're going to continue to see, even if the pandemic, like say today they make an announcement, pandemic's over, I think the fallout is still going to be there for a while, for a few years is how I see it. And, you know, I was talking to Susan and Jocelyn earlier, in August of 2021, the other counselor that I work with in at KCHC left. He moved, and so I've been the only counselor there. And it is very isolating, and at times very just feels very lonely. And of course, I can reach out to people. It's not like I don't have that capability, but it's really different when you're working in an environment where you have other people who are doing the same sort of thing around you. And you're able to like walk down to their office and say, hey, you know, I'm sort of struggling today, or whatever it is. I recently went to a actual live conference in February. And one of the kind of overarching themes was that people had this sense of isolation. And I have to tell you, it was really great to be in a group of 50 therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, and just to be around that energy and be able to share our experiences and just, yeah, it was good.
So is it group therapy then? I mean, is that the resolution for all of us, that we're all in an isolated position, and the more we can eventually get back together again, the less need there'll be for mental health counseling?
I don't know if I would go so far as to say that, but I would certainly say that being able to gather in groups is part of the human condition. We crave that connection, and we crave being able to be around other people. So there is something to that. I don't think we all need to be in group therapy, though.
No. We're that's just the way we're made. You know, we seek each other to feel safe, and that was taken away from us. You know, what do you do when you're frightened? You go receive comfort from somebody that you feel safe with. You know, and that may be someone at home. It may be that person at home isn't safe. You know, so where do you find safe people? Oh, wait a minute, I can't go out. You know, so our children especially, you know, some of them were very vulnerable. So, yeah, we naturally do that. We naturally, and for fun and for meaning, traditions, all the things that we do when we gather together. You know, fun is a need. Connection is a need. You die without it.
Is it because there aren't enough people to fill the vacant slots, that we're not filling positions, and that the wait lists are so long?
That is part of it, yeah. At Canna, we lost several members of our behavioral health department early in the pandemic because people were taking stock of things, and there were several people who were not originally from Alaska who wanted to be closer to family, understandable. We have been able to expand our department again, and fingers crossed it will be more stable, but that was also a huge thing with the wait lists and wait for services that we had more need, and our capacity, ability to provide services went down as we lost members of our department.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it possible to fill in the gap with teleconferencing with people that don't live here?
Yes, and we have started to do some of that to meet the need that we have.
So what other kinds of things have you had to do to change the way you do business to deliver services for the last couple of years?
I think for Canna, it wasn't as big an adjustment because we have used telehealth regularly for years because we also serve the villages. So, and before I worked at CAN, I worked in another tribal health agency, so I'm used to using video conferencing. And sometimes if, you know, the village stuff goes down and maybe you have to just use the phone. So I think for us, it wasn't nearly the adjustment that for some other agencies who didn't regularly use telehealth.
Yeah, I would agree, because we really didn't use telehealth at the clinic until the pandemic. And the way that's really impacted my work has been, as I said earlier, the purpose of me being in the clinic is to provide short, brief interventions. Well, now I'm providing long-term therapy, which is fine. I mean, it's the work and I love doing it, but it's not really what the intention of our clinic is. So it's made it a little more problematic trying to find therapists for people who might need specialized or more intensive therapy. So we have established a relationship with a counseling service out of Anchorage. And so oftentimes I will refer people there. But again, that's all telehealth. And for some people, that just doesn't work.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had to switch to telehealth, and we were working in our homes at first, just like everybody else. It was a big adjustment for us. We were not doing any telehealth except for once in a while we would do it with our psychiatrist. So we all had to learn about that, you know, the ethics of doing virtual work and get comfortable with it. It's really interesting. Some of the barriers that I anticipated actually weren't there. I think, Jocelyn, you're trained in EMDR too, mm-hmm. eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, which is kind of a state-of-the-art trauma recovery based intervention. And you have to really monitor people when you're doing it. And I got so I could do that. I could do that with people virtually. And have good results. So I was very surprised, and I also found that some people preferred the virtual, mm-hmm. you know, and some people were more comfortable in their homes, so they could have their pet there. I just recently did a session with someone. It was so amazing. We were at kind of a crucial point in the session, and her cat came up to her and sat on her heart, and that would never have happened in my office. And I laughingly said, well, I think you can charge your cat for the therapy today, you know, because it was just really a beautiful thing. It was very comforting. So surprising things happen. There's been some positive experiences that I did not anticipate with the virtual. However, most of my clients are coming in face-to-face now. But I do remember the first time we had been doing all of our sessions, of course, virtually. The first time someone came in person, I went into kind of a shock or alarm. It's like, oh my gosh, what do I do? I was like, I didn't know what to do. It was so odd. You know, I got over that quickly.
I was nervous too. When I was back in the office and people started coming in, I felt like, you know, I had just gotten out of school again. I was kind of nervous because I was, oh my God, am I going to know what to, it was just different.
Yeah, you adapt to that medium. It's funny, you don't realize you've done that, and then.
Well, you have a lot of experience. I remember when the Dr. Smith used to come in a lot and talk about, and Dr. Jones as well, what was happening at the hospital in terms of the calls for interventions in the emergency room or just in the hospital and regular visits of needing to bring in specialists to talk to our intake. And that those numbers were starting to get pretty big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the numbers, I'm also, well, I'm now just a substitute, but I've been a member of the on-call psychiatric emergency team for the past 10 years, and now I'm transitioning out, so I'm just a substitute for the team. Yes, we definitely saw numbers increase, and also the need to have somebody there. Really, it would be ideal to have a social worker at the hospital, because there's needs not just for, you know, because our team is there for crises, but there's all kinds of people that come in that, you know, are really struggling, but it's not a crisis, you know, it's not imminent risk. And there's a huge need for that. You know, the hospital sees those people, those vulnerable people. You know, they'll see them for a medical reason, and then there's, you know, chronic depression or anxiety going on. It's really affecting the quality of their life. And yeah, so, yes.
So is it an intake question if it's a person that comes from the Kodiak Community Health Center that's admitted to the hospital, then the referral for that person goes to you folks? Or if it's a CANA patient, the CANA emergency team comes in? Is that how it works?
No, there's one team. Oh, it's one team, and Providence provides it. We have a grant. However, we collaborate, you know. I mean, we refer people out to, if they're already seeing a therapist or if they're a CANA beneficiary or they prefer CANA, we refer them to CANA.
Okay.
You know, and especially the substance use program, we do not have one right now, and CANA is the only game in town, and so we definitely, you know, refer people there. Heidi has, sometimes she has patients. Now you're seeing people for longer term therapy, but it used to be, you know, she would be the one referring to us, so, yeah.
So are those, as we're 2 years into this, are the numbers of the referrals from the hospital then starting to go down?
Oh, you mean to other agencies for counseling?
The critical need for people coming in for emergency room services to that have secondary problems too?
Well, I'm not sure that I've done enough research on that to answer that question. However, the numbers are definitely going up. I mean, I did a tally for youth, and they increased almost 100% in the last 2 years, twice as many youth. And the school clinicians that I supervise do risk assessments. That's part of our contract with KIBSD. And our risk assessments have almost doubled, too. So we're seeing more people in crises, and you can just kind of read between the line. Well, there's a lot of people that don't meet that criteria, that threshold yet, but definitely, you know, are hurting.
And I wonder too how much of that is the kids going back to school, because traditionally referrals will go down in the summer when kids are out of school. When they start, things start to be noticed, the needs identified, and you know, services are suggested or referred. So the kids have been at home learning, and now they're going back to school, and especially if there's an additional level of anxiety or acuity of whatever, that's going to be identified now that they're back in school, and thus the referral. So that actually, that makes a lot of sense too, because we would see that pattern every year, mm-hmm. pretty much when they came back in the fall.
That's exactly right, Jocelyn. When the school clinicians continued to work when school was out, and they would just reach out to their students virtually or on the phone, risk assessments, there were no risk assessments because they weren't seeing it. You know, it wasn't in their face.
Right.
But and a lot of the kids actually dropped out of counseling services at that point. You know, parents weren't at home. You know, it lost its novelty. Whereas when you're in the school, they've got a captive audience you can really see. So, really good point.
Anecdotally, too, I noticed that the teenagers I worked with seemed to either do really well with telehealth or they just couldn't without that face-to-face connection. They just didn't, and they were like, yeah, let's, like, I'll call you guys if I'm still needing help when things are back to normal. So it was much more dramatic, at least anecdotally for me, than the adults. They were either did really well or they're just, like, very disconnected and weren't really benefiting much.
Okay. So looking back over the past 2 years and kind of going back to March 2020 when the pandemic started, I remember I was in grad school, and it seemed the pandemic really kind of magnified a lot of mental health issues, especially amongst my fellow grad students, where we already had fatigue and burnout, but then coupled with pandemic fatigue and burnout and living in this constant state of survival and crises. And it's also been reported by the World Health Organization that there is a 25% increase in anxiety and depression worldwide. So how has Kodiak fared in this regard? What were the trends that you saw throughout the pandemic with your patients and new things popping up?
There was definitely an increase in anxiety and depression among my patients, a dramatic increase. I would say it's probably in line, I don't have the numbers, but I would say it's probably in line with what you quoted from the World Health Organization. And in the very beginning, people were so anxious about what was going to happen and what did this mean. And often I would tell people, get off social media, stop watching the news. When you do want information, go to a reliable source to get information, and just kind of step back a little bit. That's one thing that will help with your anxiety. And many people did that. Some people weren't able to do that, but many people did that. But yeah, definitely a dramatic increase.
I would agree. One thing too that seems, again, this is anecdotal, this is with my caseload, that I've noticed is the immediate anxiety for self-safety seemed to really plateau and then stabilize, start going down, but a lot of folks have high-risk people in their lives, and so that anxiety about the health and safety of their loved ones, that took a lot longer, and that's been much slower to reduce because, of course, your natural instinct is to want to protect the people that you love. Mm-hmm. And there's only so much you can control. We all wish there was way more than we can actually control. So the anxiety about the safety of other people seemed to linger a lot longer. Fears for elderly relatives, small relatives, chronic health conditions, immune compromised, etc. That is still very much an issue for people. At least anecdotally, a lot of the folks I work with, like after the initial shock of it, and people either they got sick or they didn't, they felt better, but they still had this really heightened anxiety about other people in their lives, especially if they were in a high-risk category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with what Jocelyn and Heidi are saying. Definitely saw more increased level of anxiety and depression. I think for all the reasons that have already been stated, I don't know if I need to add anything to that.
Yeah, okay. So, and kind of going back to our younger populations, our youth, it was there's a significant increase in the number of children and teens seeking help for anxiety and depression over the past 2 years across the country. And some reports had emergency room visits among these groups, showing a 25 to 31% increase. How did that happen here in Kodiak? Did that happen here with our youth?
Yeah, it did happen here.
Yeah.
And at first we couldn't really tell because we were meeting with children or students virtually.
Mm-hmm.
However, as when students returned to school, like Jocelyn said, more referrals would go up, we would see what was going on. And families, that were already, vulnerable, financially vulnerable, food insecurity, parents maybe struggling themselves with a substance use issue. Those kids, of course, it just got more amped up.
Mm-hmm.
because everybody was anxious and there weren't answers for all of those things. Child care especially was a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
We would be seeing kids at home, 12-year-old caring for their 3-year-old brother just because it was necessary. It wasn't
mm-hmm.
neglect. So these kids building pressure. Yeah, and then they get to school and everybody else, especially in middle school, where they're not quite, fully formed and don't have that delayed gratification thing going too well. It could be really, really a cruel setting at times sometimes for especially those vulnerable students. So we would see them in the emergency room more I mentioned it was actually twice as many students in 2020, it kind of slowly built within,
mm-hmm.
As in compared to 2019. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's happening now, now that we're moving kind of from being a pandemic to this being moving towards an endemic and kind of life slowly returning back to normal? What is happening now as we are going forward?
Well, I can answer that from my interaction with KIVSD, but I don't want to steal the show here. Really good things are actually happening now. The school district hired a social worker, and she's really been involved with families, getting them support and helping them to kind of streamline getting their kids to services, whatever those services may be. It's been really amazing. And our clinician team works really closely with her. Tanya Silva Johnson is her name. And I work really closely with my counterpart, Kim Saunders, who's the director of special education. And we're really working on close communication. If kids go in for a crisis visit, follow-up, making sure that the school knows the safety plan and that, only trusted adults. And so that we're making sure there's a good postvention follow-up. Also, again, making sure those kids get in. It may be crisis. Canada has crisis visits available. We have crisis visits available. So they don't have to wait forever to be seen. So things are actually improving, The school counselors... So there's the school clinicians that work for Providence, and then there's the school guidance counselors. They have been taking up a lot of the slack, seeing kids, for emotional reasons and not for, helping them make sure their grades are up and stuff. That's another reason for the angst that our kids are experiencing, falling behind in school.
Mm-hmm.
Many students fell behind because, Jocelyn mentioned, the virtual doesn't work for all students. And maybe parents weren't there able to support them to succeed. So that's been a real problem, is trying to catch those kids and support them to get back on track academically. And of course you feel terrible about yourself. I mean, if you're not doing well in school, that's definitely a source of anxiety and depression for our students.
Yeah, early on that switch, some kids did really well and were really good at structuring their time because, when you're in school, you have such a concrete structure. You're in a class. You've got a bell that rings. There's all these things that help them shift gears between to get into kind of school mode and between subjects. But at home, a lot of kids really struggled. Some didn't I was really impressed by how some of the teenagers I worked with did. And so then they have to adjust back to that and back to things like if there's people they don't like at school, the irritations of seeing those people, maybe very unkind things being said that they haven't really had to deal with, at least not face to face. So those are, they had one adjustment to being at home, and then they had to adjust again. And it's been, I think for the most part, kids have done really well, at least the ones I work with, but it has been really challenging. And there are some kids that have struggled more than others with that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting what you said, Jocelyn, because what we saw at the clinic was this. 2020, you know, we were continuing to see kids, but at the beginning of 2021, January and February, there was really a big uptick in the number of kids coming in and the number of kids who were experiencing suicidal ideation. And I think part of that had to do with just what you were saying, making that adjustment back into a school environment. There was the adjustment not being in the school environment and then the adjustment back. And as you pointed out, Susan, middle school especially can be a very challenging kind of cruel environment in many ways, and I think the kids were experiencing that, especially the ones who weren't doing well, you know, the ones who are struggling with their grades or with social interactions.
Worked with a lot of kids on being able to shut off the social media and having times when, whether it's putting your phone in airplane mode, you know, the anxiety about, I had to have a client explain to me 2 or 3 years ago what being left on read on Snapchat was, because I was like, what are you talking about? Because it was this huge, huge thing for this young lady. And so there are some kids who actually use the opportunity that that afforded to get better boundaries socially with themselves, and then were kind of taken by surprise when they actually had to deal with people that are saying ugly things to them face to face. That was very interesting, because then all of a sudden they had gotten used to being able to turn things off and set boundaries with their phone or computer. But they can't do that if someone's literally two desks over from them. So they had to adapt again.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is happening at the middle school that's been really positive is Lunch Bunch. And it's super popular. So the kids can meet with adult and they just have a topic for the day. And there's just a like group of 12, I think, they do at a time. And the kids just love it. They love talking about interesting topics, and even the really socially shy or reserved kids participate, and it's really popular. Yeah.
We got a question from a listener. Arthur in Kodiak, a military veteran, says, thank you for what you're doing. You are unsung heroes in our community, and your work is especially important since the pandemic started. So not a question, but a thank you for being there for people. You mentioned PTSD, and I know that the research has tended to show that a lot of the long COVID people are experiencing not only the physical effects of having had COVID, but that a lot of mental health issues that are prolonged as well. Are you starting to see more clients that have had COVID and are now needing continued treatment for mental health issues?
That are related to?
Well, I'm just thinking, it sounds to me kind of like the type of reaction that people that are experiencing PTSD have, that you would see in somebody that's...
Mm-hmm. And medical trauma is definitely something that can lead to PTSD. I have a couple of people I've worked with who did have significant PTSD following medical emergencies. So it is something that's been around, and definitely... long COVID symptoms that were very severe or that just haven't resolved, especially if it's related to being able to do your daily activities or, you know, the brain fog that really was a lot for people to struggle with. They were, I guess, you know, not really prepared to just have their minds not work the way they're used to it working and not being able to do the things after the immediate infection subsided. So I personally haven't seen anybody who, like, a long COVID infection has resulted, like, that's the primary issue, but it's definitely been a complicating factor for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
I would too. I haven't personally seen anyone in my, you know, a client that struggles with that, but I know some people that have, and it is very debilitating. You know, initially it's almost like having Alzheimer's at first, you know, and then it slowly clears up, but it is, you know, it's depressing, and it makes you anxious when your brain doesn't work right. And I think, yeah, it's traumatizing, because we count on our bodies and minds to work. And if they're not working and you don't know what to do about it, you know, it's that the helplessness in response to something that's very threatening.
And then if you feel hopeless, thinking, what if this never comes back? I'm never going to be the way that I was before. That's really a terrifying thought.
I guess my question is, you know, we spend a lot of times with doctors talking about, okay, the person had COVID, this is how we treat it after the fact, and we've made some advances in how we do that. But on the mental health side, we don't talk about it. Is there specific things that you need to do to address somebody that has those type of symptoms? Is there something that you can do for them, I guess?
So with any client, I mean, the first thing you do is you give them education and making sure, Heidi mentioned, make sure a trusted resource. So getting information, you know, find out what's helped other people. You know, usually the medical community can tell you, you know, what's been helpful. I mean, it's new for us. So the verdict's not out, you know, best treatment, you know, information, and also finding any kind of way to have agency, because it's that helplessness. Well, what can you do? Okay, you can't do this. What can you do? What's been helping? You know, I know that people using just slow, deep diaphragmic breathing has helped them at least with their anxiety and helps them kind of get through the, well, you know, the disappointment or discouragement they feel. But it's a lot of different things. People are using alternative medicine kinds of approaches, you know, homeopathy, acupuncture, other methods too. So it's, you know, I think anything that can help you with agency and feeling like there's something you can do about it, and researching is always going to help you to feel less traumatized.
Yeah, and going what you said about the breathing, I agree with that 100%. And also just the education, it's a respiratory based illness. So I can speak for myself. I had COVID in January, and my heart rate is actually still not back to where it was beforehand, thanks to the smartwatch. It still goes up way easier. And a lot of people don't necessarily think about how their breathing patterns, their blood pressure, their heart rate affects the way that they feel emotionally. But when you have something like how the brain works, signals work in two directions, so you can get more anxious and activated physically because of what's going on in your mind, what you're thinking of, what you're seeing, experiencing, etc. It can happen the other way around too. So if your body is activated because of something, or your heart rate shoots up easily, your blood pressure is higher, struggling to breathe is a huge thing. And we were talking about this before we came on here with the masks. A lot of the folks I worked with PTSD and vets too, they have a lot of bad memories associated with feeling like they can't breathe, maybe being choked, something covering their face, having a mask on in a war zone, a gas mask or something. That was a huge thing for people. And really simple interventions, like different breathing exercises, were some of the most effective. And I think now that a lot of the immediate stuff has passed, people don't really consider that their bodies may still be overreacting to things, even months after they've had COVID, and to kind of give themselves a little bit of grace for that. Like, it's okay, there's nothing wrong with, people feel defective sometimes, and that can really lead to anxiety and a lot of hopelessness. But teaching them skills to, and basic things that anyone can do, those have been some of the most effective things and just reminding them that they're not defective, they're not a broken person, that something is going on. If your heart rate shoots up, if your blood pressure shoots up or down, blood sugars, whatever, that's a biological reaction. Of course it's going to affect you. That's okay. And there's ways that you can try to deal with it. It doesn't mean there's no hope.
Yeah, I agree. Deep breathing is the key. But also, just what you were saying, Josh, to build on that a little bit, letting people know that what they're feeling is normal.
Yeah.
And that they aren't defective, I think, is really key to, mm-hmm. you know, trying to normalize the situation for them as much as you can. And the other thing is just being there and holding space, because mm-hmm. oftentimes what people need is someone who's going to listen to them, hear them out, and then provide some skills, but really just to listen to them.
Without judgment.
Without judgment, yeah.
It's rare, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And kind of building off of this, building off of our conversation today, now that we're shifting gears to COVID being endemic, and kind of I've been reading and talking to people about this kind of re-entry anxiety of, you know, masks are coming off. How do we know we're being safe around people when we're not wearing masks? We don't know who's vaccinated or not. Plus, you can still get COVID if you are vaccinated. And so I know some people where that anxiety is just kind of crippling. And how can we tackle re-entry into life after being in the pandemic for so long?
I think it's really important for people to assess what their needs are, mm-hmm. okay? Because we are in this time which is very confusing, right? Mm-hmm. I just traveled over the weekend. In the airports, on the airplanes, you have to wear masks. Once you get out of the airport, it's hit or miss. Some places say yes, some places say no. A lot of people aren't wearing masks. I think people have to kind of decide individually mm-hmm. what their risk is and what risk they're willing to take. I think that's a piece of it as we go into this. I was feeling, I had this sense like maybe we're coming out of this and things will normalize. And then on the news this morning, I heard that there's another upshot in Europe of COVID. So I think that kind of up and down stuff is really hard to deal with. And I think people really have to kind of decide for themselves what works for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's kind of how I play it for myself. It's like, do I feel safe? Is it okay for me not to wear a mask? Do I feel better wearing a mask? Then maybe I'm going to continue to do that for a while and see how things play out. Yeah. And then just reassuring people, you know, again, providing that support, being non-judgmental, and helping them work their way through it. There were people that I worked with during the pandemic who were, like, very adamant about not wearing masks, not getting the vaccination, you know, and helping them work through that for themselves and supporting them as I could. I might not agree with them, but supporting mm-hmm. them nonetheless.
I think that's really important what you said. I think you have to decide for yourself what you're comfortable with and make peace with that, but also respect others' mm-hmm. right to decide for themselves.
Right.
And I think that's been so huge. You know, and that's something that comes when you've got lots of anxious people, is we tend to make enemy images. That's a term. It's like, mm-hmm. well, I don't agree with you, so you're the bad guy. Well, you know, when people sit down and dialogue, you know, you really find out, oh, they do have a legitimate reason for not wanting to wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though that doesn't make sense scientifically, you know, to just respect that, you know, and obviously not if it becomes dangerous, but as we do this reentry, let's kind of shed that, you know, and kind of listen to each other and respect each other's right to decide what's best for them.
So the final question of the day, is there anything that we can take from this whole pandemic experience that's a positive for ourselves, for our community?
Oh, absolutely. People are so resilient. If you had asked people a few years ago and presented this as a hypothetical situation, a lot of people would have been like, oh my gosh, everything would have fallen apart. I would have fallen apart, you know, it would have been chaos and disaster in the streets, and people everywhere, including here in Kodiak, it was really challenging at times. And for us, I feel more than most, there's even more shipping delays for us. On the other hand, people were used to it. I think a lot of people really surprised themselves at how well they were able to adapt and to keep moving forward and just living. Maybe just a reminder that we're a lot more resilient and a lot stronger than sometimes we give ourselves credit for.
I would totally agree with that. Humans are very resilient, and I think this pandemic has proven that.
I think it's also shown how community-minded Kodiak is. Mm-hmm. There was some just immediate responses to needs like mentioned in Facebook or just organization of all different kinds of agencies and entities to help people. I was just so impressed. And I think that helped with our resilience, knowing that, mm-hmm. hey, people are listening, there's support, I'm not alone in this. I work for Providence, so I was informed of all that Providence was doing to get ready in case we had an overflow at the hospital. I mean, we were on it, you know, and incident command or the leaders of our city, you know, and we heard from them regularly on KMXT, so, you know, and just all the rallying and reaching out to the kids, you know, Kodiak Arts Council, the museums, you know, the school district. I mean, it was really beautiful. It made me feel like, wow. We're all in this together, and we're not alone.
Yeah, the way people, the kindness that you saw mm-hmm. and people reaching out to help, all the, you know, doing shopping for elders who were very high risk and concerned. I know Canada did a lot, sending things out to the villages as well, mm-hmm. doing more medication deliveries, all of those things. And it wasn't just agencies. Everyday people were really jumping in to help. There was a thing on Facebook. I forget who organized it to do shopping and pick up things for people who were sick or who were very high risk. And there was they didn't have to do that. There was no real reason other than they wanted to help people. It's pretty amazing.
That's always been one of the things I've loved about living in Kodiak is that it is a community and people really do respond when tough things happen and really pull together. And I think we proved that again through this pandemic.
Any final words of wisdom, of advice to give to people in the community who are listening?
If you're struggling, reach out. There are people here who are able and willing to help you. So you don't have to do this alone. If you need help, reach out. That's what I would say.
Reaching out it takes a type of strength too. A lot of people still unfortunately think that asking for help means you're weak or that you're giving up, and it's not. To reach out and trust somebody by asking them for help, that takes a lot of strength, and to keep doing that.
Well, we all have friends and acquaintances though. What about intervention type? You know, what do we do for people that we think need some help? How do you get them in? How do you get them to engage with somebody?
You know, a lot of therapists or counselors or whatever you want to call us clinicians, we'll meet with people for 15 minutes. Let's just meet and greet and see if you're comfortable. And to normalize the process of finding a therapist that you've, you know, that is a good fit, because you're not necessarily going to fit with everyone. Also for them to educate themselves, or you can educate them about what it would look like if you went in to see a therapist. Most insurance plans pay for therapy, you know, so you can kind of get those barriers out of the way. I think our industry could definitely do better with removing some of those barriers, yeah, too. But we're working on that as well. There's been an industry change due to COVID as well. Let's try to make mental health more accessible.
And if you're approaching a friend, you know, just encouraging them, say that you care about them and are not judging them, but you're worried. It's okay to say that to people. And it, you know, sometimes people will take that as that you're saying there's something wrong with them, that they're weak or they're not competent or whatever, but just having someone to talk to who's not a member of your immediate family or friend circle can be really useful.
Well, and it's normal, isn't it? I mean, supposedly after this, even before the pandemic, half of us were sort of out there a little bit. Mm-hmm. But with the pandemic, it can't help but all of us need a little help, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah.
We just need 400 more counselors in town.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we just all need to slow down and listen to each other without judgment. And that is, when you're anxious, you don't want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's important to be encouraging, as what was said, but also I also think sometimes just talking to someone and kind of letting it simmer maybe, and then maybe at another point in time talking to them again, you know, planting that seed. Mm-hmm. and sometimes people will react to that and sometimes they won't, but right. But that's what you can do.
Well, what you've done is provide us with an hour's worth of really interesting conversation. I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us and telling us what's going on and what to be aware of.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. All it's right. Always a pleasure. And Lynn.
Thank you.
Lynn, we'll be back again in another couple of weeks with another edition of The Long Haul. Thanks for being with us today. It's down the road.
Thanks for tuning in to this edition of The Long Haul, our new program focusing on the long-term effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the Kodiak community. The Long Haul is a joint production of the Kodiak History Museum and KMXT. It will be heard monthly here on KMXT going into the spring. Check our Facebook page or our website, kmxt.org, for more information on upcoming shows and topics. If you have ideas or guest suggestions for future shows, send an email to longhaul@kmxt.org or call the station or the Kodiak History Museum. Have a safe and pleasant day tomorrow. We're all in this together.